people who went for it and finally achieved something out of it were the guys who went after that forbidden effect, just like your friend that you mentioned. So it's not always bad, but then we have to look at it from the Islamic perspective as well. So we go for a break and we come back to see what's more.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
The word forbidden usually has got this connotation that, okay, I have to try more to get into it. And I guess that's related to our nature. That's how our nature has been put there inside of us. To go for stuff that everybody else says that you cannot go, that is forbidden, it's out of your power, something, it works as a challenge when it is forbidden to you. So, yes, you're listening to IRIB English Radio, and this is Back to Reality. Sister Zainab and Brother Liaghat are helping us with the topic of forbidden effect. Well, now I know what is forbidden effect, but then I need to know, do we have any recommendations or any suggestions or any narrations in Islamic perspective regarding the forbidden effect?
So about forbidden effect, normally, just like it said, the more it is told not to do something, and it is said as vice versa, like the thing
increased
is done.
Increased attraction.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we can see this, I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was about Abu Zar Ghaffari, right?
Mm-hmm.
When he came to Makkah, or if I'm not mistaken, it's Salman. Either Salman Farsi or it's Abu Zar Ghaffari. And when the person comes to Makkah, and the Quraysh tell him not to go to a person called Muhammad,
yeah,
sallallahu alaihi wasallam, because he is a magician, mm-hmm, he's a sorcerer and stuff like that.
He will enchant you.
And he was like, wow, who is this person? Like, and he was told to keep cotton in his ears and not to listen to him. Like, of course, Rasulullah used to recite the Holy Quran, isn't it? So it was then that he used his intellect. What should I do? Should I listen to this person? Like, should I hear him or not? And at the end of the day, he was like, let me just listen to what he's saying and I can decide whether it's right or wrong. And that is the time he listens and he feels that it is truth and he accepts the correct religion, mm-hmm, the religion of Islam, of course, through Amir al-Mu'mineen. Imam Ali takes him to Rasulullah and that's when he accepts Islam. Okay, so about how to counter this, like I would say, you have to speak openly about the rules instead of just enforcing them. Example, when we speak to teens, okay, we have to speak about why this rule is. Example, when your teen comes to you and he's like, okay, I want to do this. And you say him, no, you're not allowed to. Okay, this is not allowed. That's it. Instead of saying no, give them the reason. Like, okay, this is not allowed because. Yeah. This because helps your teen or the child, whoever it might be, even the elder, to act, to ponder upon what it's told, the reason, whether it's correct or not.
Mm-hmm.
And then he can put it into action.
Yeah.
Rather than just enforcing, okay, you're not allowed to do this, you're allowed to do this. This is like a police thing, okay, or kind of judging thing.
So we have to start the answer with an if clause.
Uh-huh, exactly.
If you touch the fire, you'll get burned.
Mm-hmm.
If you do this, something happens to you. So that's one solution if you want to tackle with that issue with your children. And we know that childhood has got a very important role in who you're going to become in future. If we want to go for some more of solutions, what would be your recommendation, Sister Zainab?
Number one, I would appreciate what brother said, understanding the wisdom behind the prohibition. If something is prohibited, especially in Islam,
mm-hmm,
there's definitely always wisdom behind it.
Like for example, the issue of hijab.
Right. It's for both. Like chastity, number one, mm-hmm, is for both men and women. But it has an increased sense for women because women are blessed with more beauty, physically, apparently, also in their intellects.
Of course.
So, yeah. I hope Brother Liaghat does not get offended.
But no worries. Go ahead. Go ahead. I'm listening.
Imam Sadiq actually says that. And he says that women should not feel pride because of this. They should express gratitude because
exactly
of this increased wisdom, beauty. So It said it's according to like religion has this wisdom behind it, like whatever is beautiful, keep it concealed. It's not meant for every third person, right?
So for whatever that is forbidden for you, be it hijab or be it anything else, like a special food that is forbidden for you, there's a wisdom behind it.
Rather than looking at it as a restriction, mm-hmm. I must go and look at the wisdom behind it. And I think another solution to it is to look at the positives. For example, why do I always look at the forbidden laws or forbidden rules? Why don't I look for what is allowed?
Yeah.
When I always keep my mind focused towards what is not allowed, I may take things negatively always. So just to think positively about Deen, I have to be thinking, looking at what is allowed.
Yeah, and do not look at the little box you have created for yourself of the things that is not allowed or forbidden for you. Go for this vast ocean of the things that are allowed for you and not just forbidden. By the way, I just mentioned this very thing that it's not like this, that whatever that is forbidden, you don't even think about it. I guess even in Islam, we don't have such a recommendation that you have to omit the question that you have in your mind. No, we do not deal with issues like this. We go and search, and as you just mentioned rightly, we search for the wisdom behind everything. If there is any way, yes, I can find it. But if there is no way, I don't have to dig deep into the Pandora's box. So now this is actually the very last part of today's episode. I wish both of you could conclude whatever was said in today's episode about the forbidden effect.
You can kind of give other options which are related to it maybe. There's one thing called choice and control. When your kid wants something, okay, like he wants to play more of the video game, example.
By the way, these things could be applied to adults as well.
Yeah, definitely.
The adults, when they fixate their perspective on something, mm-hmm. it's very difficult to tell them not to.
Exactly. That is where you give them choice.
Yeah.
Example. I'm just giving you a simple example. That is like when the kid wants to play more, you're going to say, okay, either you do your homework or you play for 2 more minutes. Mm-hmm. You see, you are giving him choice and you are also controlling the scenario completely, actually. You're giving him choice. Of course, he's going to say 2 more minutes, okay? Mm-hmm. But the 2 minutes is very limited, okay?
Yeah.
So it's choice as well as control at the same time. It can be applied in all, of course, in all the age groups, I would say. And or try to distract him, try to distract the person from the topic, from whatever forbidden effect is happening over there. Try to distract strategy, I would say. Through these, and of course, there are other means as well. Like you can praise him or that person. Like you can praise for the act and tell him, you know what? Example, you know, you do that act as well, more beautifully. Like example, he's doing something which shouldn't be done. And you praise for something which he likes to do, okay?
Yeah.
And which is allowed, okay?
Yeah.
So praising and diverting in mm-hmm. that manner. And there are different strategies, I would say. And inshallah, through these strategies, I would say, inshallah, it can be
maybe
solved.
Maybe in future, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe in future we would have time to go through those psychological strategies.
Inshallah.
Because that's very important, I guess.
Yes,
okay,
yes.
Sister Zainab?
Well, I think, you know, if you start with yourself, if you start resisting small satanic temptations, if you start fighting with them, this practice of self-discipline will help you overcome mm-hmm. the forbidden effect. Because when I start with small steps of self-discipline, it will increase my capability, it will increase my patience, and it will ultimately help me see things. And if I educate myself about faith, about strength and faith, if I educate myself about Islam as well, it will, this change in perspective will actually help me look at things differently out of the box.
Yeah. Well, I guess the road not taken is always pretty much enchanting for everyone out there, but we have to remember the story of Adam and Eve as well. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us until another session. I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
يا رب العالمين Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, Lati Umma, rise again, let us see daylight again, once again.
In the limelight.
An unnamed Israeli source quoted by Khan reportedly said that Benjamin Netanyahu refused to accept a deal to satisfy Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who had threatened to leave the government if the deal was signed. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, the Zionist regime prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, lost an opportunity to reach a prisoner swap deal with Hamas in July to appease his far-right coalition partners, National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir and Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation, Khan, has reported. According to the report cited by the Anadolu news agency, Hamas was willing to release several Israeli hostages without demanding a full ceasefire in return. The report suggested that Hamas' willingness at the time was an attempt to link the first and second phases of a U.S. ceasefire proposal, which included humanitarian aid. The report did not provide further details. However, although Hamas has repeatedly said that it would only release the Israeli captives if the deal resulted in a complete cessation of Israel's ongoing assault on Gaza. At the time, the U.S. proposal included three phases. The first involved an immediate ceasefire, the release of women, the elderly, and the wounded Israeli captives, and a prisoner exchange, as well as the withdrawal of Israeli forces from populated areas of Gaza. It also included increasing humanitarian aid, rebuilding basic services, and facilitating the return of civilians to their homes across Gaza. The second phase required the release of all remaining hostages and the complete withdrawal of Israeli regime forces from Gaza, aiming to end the crisis definitely. The third phase involved the reconstruction of Gaza over several years and the return of Israeli troops remains. Khan said that Netanyahu rejected the proposal, particularly opposing the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, with areas like the Philadelphia Corridor and Netzarim Axis becoming obstacles to the ceasefire process, according to Anadolu. An unnamed Israeli source quoted by the broadcaster said that Netanyahu's refusal to accept the deal was to satisfy Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who had threatened to leave the government if the deal was signed. Mediation efforts led by the U.S., Egypt, and Qatar have so far failed to achieve a Gaza ceasefire and prisoner swap deal. Recently, the International Criminal Court issued arrest warrants for child killer Benjamin Netanyahu and his former war minister, Yoav Gallant, for war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza. Senior Hamas official Sami Abu Zohri said recently that the Palestinian resistance movement's utmost priority is halting and ending the aggression on Gaza. In a statement, Abu Zohri reiterated its position of not settling for understandings that do not alleviate the suffering of our people, guarantee their return to their homes, and ensure full reconstruction of all life facilities. He also highlighted the plight of the Palestinian people in Gaza, slamming the West and particularly the United States regime for continuing to support Israel in its genocidal war in the Gaza Strip. The Hamas leader said this brutal campaign would not have persisted without Western, particularly American, support in the form of financial and military aid, as well as political and media backing, adding that such support justifies and covers up the occupation's crimes and obstructs any role by the UN Security Council to stop this genocide. Flouting a UN Security Council resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire, the Zionist regime has faced international condemnation amid its continued brutal offensive on Gaza. Currently on trial before the International Court of Justice for Genocide Against Palestinians, the Israeli regime has been waging a devastating war on Gaza since October 7, 2023. According to Gaza's Ministry of Health, at least 45,000 Palestinians have, to date, been martyred, and at least 104,567 wounded. Moreover, at least 11,000 people are unaccounted for, presumed dead, under the rubble of their homes throughout the Gaza Strip. The Israeli regime war has also resulted in an acute famine, mostly in northern Gaza, resulting in the death of many Palestinians, mostly children. The Israeli regime aggression has also resulted in the forceful displacement of nearly 2 million people from all over the Gaza Strip, with the vast majority of the displaced forced into the densely crowded southern city of Rafah near the border with Egypt in what has become Palestine's largest mass exodus since 1948 Nakba. Later in the war, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians began moving from the south to the central Gaza in a constant search for safety.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
On Saturday, July 7th, 2012, the streets of Tel Aviv witnessed a demonstration of over 15,000 Israeli citizens. The protesters opposed a law exempting Orthodox religious students from mandatory military service. While military service is compulsory for Jewish men and women at age 18, 3 years for men, and 21 months for women, Orthodox Jews are exempt. Although married women, mothers, and Arab citizens are also exempt, men may be called up for periodic service until age 42 and women until 24. Furthermore, Israeli citizens participate in 45 days of reserve training annually to maintain combat readiness. With an estimated 420,000 reservists ready for duty, 7.5% of Israel's population is constantly prepared for military service. A majority of Israeli citizens oppose this discrimination and demand the repeal of the exemption for Orthodox religious students. Days after the demonstrations, the Israeli Supreme Court declared the exemption unconstitutional, violating the principle of equality among citizens, and ordered its removal.
Hello.
However, a powerful figure whose supporters included the intensely religious parties, Shas and United Torah Judaism, parties that had consistently supported Netanyahu's premiership, insisted on maintaining the exemption for religious students. Netanyahu had no choice but to disband the Kadima Party Committee that had drafted a bill against the exemption of Orthodox Jewish men for military service. In response, Shaul Mofaz, the leader of Kadima, declared that if the committee's recommendations were not approved, his party would leave the coalition government. Only 2 months after the formation of Netanyahu's multi-party cabinet, Kadima withdrew due to this disagreement over military service. Although Kadima's departure weakened Netanyahu's government, it didn't lose its parliamentary majority. The religious parties continued to support Netanyahu, leaving him with the support of 66 out of 120 parliament members.
Israeli lawmakers voted in a secret ballot by 63 to 53 to make...
Finally, after a year and a half of debate, in March 2014, the Knesset voted on the exemption of religious students from military or national service. While a portion of the Knesset boycotted the vote, it ultimately passed with 67 votes in favor and just one against, making military service mandatory for religious students. Yair Lapid, the Israeli Minister of Finance from the Yesh Atid party, who voted in favor, celebrated the passage as he fulfilled one of his party's election promises. Lapid declared that they had achieved a revolution. However, Moshe Gafni from the United Torah Judaism party, who opposed the bill, vowed the ultra-Orthodox would not forgive Netanyahu and his partners for the harm inflicted upon religious students. A few days after the law's passage, an Orthodox religious student who had refused service was arrested. In protest, tens of thousands of Orthodox Jews dressed in black held anti-government demonstrations in Al-Quds, Ashdod, Bnei Brak, Beit Shemesh, and several other cities. Shemuel Arbach, a prominent religious leader, had repeatedly urged religious students to refuse mandatory service. Auerbach and his colleagues feared that if these young men served in the army for 3 years, they would be exposed to the secular world, become estranged from their faith, or at least have their faith shaken. Mandatory military service is not the only contentious issue between secular leaders and religious leaders in Israeli society. Years before, Shimon Peres, then president of Israel, called on the public to demonstrate against the actions of religious extremists. One such social conflict involved gender segregation in occupied territories. Ultra-Orthodox Jews advocate for the separation of men and women in public spaces, including buses. This thinking has resulted in gender segregation on over 60 bus lines in Al-Quds. These conflicts have repeatedly led to violence. In December 2011, in Beit Shemesh, west of Al-Quds, religious extremists installed signs prohibiting women from walking alongside men on the city's sidewalks. Police, acting on the governor's orders, cleared the path, but clashes ensued between the extremists and police. The extremists harassed modern women, verbally abusing them. Ultra-Orthodox Jews spat on a young girl, citing her immodest clothing as a reason. In Beit Shemesh, near Al-Quds, they threw stones at secular women and girls or attacked them with pepper spray for wearing a red blouse or walking with a man. Beit Shemesh's walls are often covered with graffiti urging women to wear modest clothing. Rabbinical patrols, groups lacking legal authorization, attack stores selling what they deem provocative clothing, spraying chemicals and bleach on the garments. The ultra-Orthodox Haredi Jewish community maintains its own distinct structure. Haredi women's attire requires covering their elbows and knees. Married women wear wigs as a form of head covering. Men wear a white shirt with long trousers and a long coat and a black hat, attire rooted in the 18th century clothing styles of Russian and Polish Jews. In Haredi culture, boys and girls attend separate schools. Haredim often oppose watching television, films, reading newspapers, or non-religious books. They also oppose the internet, and the use of mobile phones is forbidden by religious leaders. However, the Rabbinical Council has stated that complete ban on internet use is impossible as internet access has become essential for certain things. In Jerusalem, Al-Quds, regulations are posted on walls in highly visible locations within the Orthodox neighborhood of Mia Shearim. This lifestyle had led Haredim to demand concessions from the government to accommodate their religious beliefs. Exemption from military service is just one such concession. Yair Lapid, leader of the Yesh Atid party, who has consistently advocated for the conscription of religious students, told Netanyahu, "Let this law be passed or allow elections to be held. In that case, we can pass this law. If you want to pass the law abolishing exemption, Yesh Atid's votes for a coalition with you are guaranteed, and you have our votes. You must not yield to the Haredim again. Despite these efforts, Netanyahu prevented the law abolishing the exemption from being passed in the Knesset, which strained his relationship with Yair Lapid, his former finance minister. Lapid later joined the supporters of Benny Gantz, Netanyahu's strongest rival in the Blue and White Coalition Party. Netanyahu, until the end of his term, continued to prevent the implementation of the passed bill mandating military service for religious individuals. The Jerusalem Post, on April 15, 2019, reported that Avigdor Lieberman, leader of the Yisrael Beiteinu party, strongly urged the future government to implement the law on mandatory military service for religious students passed by the Israeli Knesset in March of 2014. Lieberman made this a condition for any coalition agreement with Benjamin Netanyahu. Lieberman champions the interests of secular Russian-speaking Israelis in the Knesset. Netanyahu has repeatedly, across different terms, sought support from Lieberman and his right-wing secular party to form a government and coalition. However, he has faced Lieberman's opposition due to his support for the military exemption for Orthodox religious individuals, jeopardizing his electoral chances. March 10th, 2018, Ashdod Port, Western Occupied Territories. Several thousand residents of the Ashdod Commercial Port demonstrated against the Saturday closure of businesses. In accordance with Jewish tradition, Saturday is the weekly day of rest and worship, known as Shabbat. The Torah prohibits many activities on this day, and traditional Jewish commentators consider the use of modern conveniences such as private cars and public transport to be among these prohibitions. Pressing buttons and switching on and off machines and electrical devices is forbidden on Shabbat. Shabbat begins at sunset on Friday and continues until sunset on Saturday. At 4 p.m., a siren announces the beginning of Shabbat. Minutes before sunset and the start of Shabbat, men spontaneously patrol the market to ensure all shopkeepers close their businesses on time, as keeping shops open is a violation of the religious law. Most public buses also do not operate on Saturdays. Haredi Jews have demanded that the government close roads in their residential areas on this day. They sometimes take matters into their own hands, blocking roads to prevent non-religious traffic, even throwing stones at passing vehicles. These actions by the Haredim, blocking highways, have sometimes led to violent clashes with secular Israelis. The dispute over activity on Saturdays in Israeli society has a long history. However, right-wingers in Netanyahu's government, aided by a minister affiliated with the ultra-religious faction, have succeeded in preventing shops from operating on Saturdays for years. The holding of football matches on Saturdays has also been a point of contention between ultra-Orthodox Jews and centrist and secular Zionist factions in recent years. In 2018, the Israeli Ministry of Labor and Social Affairs issued a directive resolving this conflict, permitting the holding of football matches and all related activities on Saturdays. According to the latest report from the Central Bureau of Statistics of Israel, 26% of the population of occupied territories is non-Jewish, including Arab Muslims, Christians, Druze, and followers of other religions. The remaining 74% are Jewish, with secular non-religious Jews comprising a majority of 43% of the population. Only 10% of the Jewish population are ultra-Orthodox. Benjamin Netanyahu needed the votes of this 10% to maintain political power, especially as her families are traditionally large, averaging three times the size of typical families, and they comprise over 1 million people in the Israeli population structure. Particularly in the last decade, through participation in Netanyahu's coalition government, they gained considerable influence and power, using this influence to maintain their exemption from military service. This exemption allows young religious men to pursue religious studies at their yeshivas instead of mandatory military service. These exemptions, coupled with welfare subsidies, have fueled resentment among the secular majority. The power of religious fundamentalists predates Netanyahu, stretching back to the founding of Israel. During the 1948 Declaration of Independence and the establishment of Israel, an agreement known as the Tal Law was signed and ratified between Zionist leaders and Orthodox Jews. Religious Jews considered the creation of any Jewish state a violation of Jewish will and a contravention of teachings regarding the arrival of the Messiah. However, under the Tal Law, they accepted the existence of Israel and ceased opposition in exchange for special privileges. David Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister, granted fundamentalists special benefits to secure their support. They are exempt from military service and receive government financial aid to dedicate their lives to Torah study instead of working. One of the privileges granted to religious Jews under the Tal Law was exemption from military service. In 1948, when the number of Orthodox Jews in occupied territories was 400, this special law may not have been problematic and did not undermine the principle of civic equality. However, with this number now reaching 60,000, this special treatment is more conspicuous. The influence of religious groups within the political power structure and the possibility of reverse migration if pressure is applied have complicated matters for Israeli authorities. Therefore, the Israeli regime is hesitant to confront religious factions, opting instead to manage existing conflicts and effectively appease them. One consequence of this approach has been the erosion of secular patience and the consequent immigration of secular Israelis to other parts of occupied territories. This deep rift among Israeli citizens, ostensibly united against Palestinians, is undeniable. For these fundamental Jews, the laws of the Torah supersede the desires and existence of Israel. Their unwavering commitment to their beliefs, even to the point of fighting for them, poses a serious threat to the Israeli political system. While Netanyahu and previous Israeli leaders managed to balance various factions in the past, religious groups now aim to disrupt the rules of the game established by Ben-Gurion, seeking maximum power with a minimal population. Just as Israeli secular society is fragmented and divided, so too is a religious community regarding collaboration with the secular authority and opposition to Palestinians. A faction accepts the Israeli regime participating in the Knesset and political parties and vehemently opposes Palestinians. However, opposing this group are movements like Neutral Ikarta and Left Tahor, which openly oppose Zionism and the establishment of the Israeli regime and support the Palestinians. The Neutral Ikarta movement within the occupied territories even burns the Israeli flag and carries Palestinian flags in street protests. Refuse Israeli identification and do not register births or marriages with Israeli authorities.
So Zionism came along, and these people who had nothing with religion, they were against religion, and they decided they needed this national home. Mm-hmm. And so they decided, though, but they need support. So in every facet, the Zionism and eventually the State of Israel rebels against God is a criminal act.
Religious or secular Zionism, this is the Israeli regime's dilemma. Founded on religious motivations, it simultaneously seeks to be classified among Western secular systems, a complex and ambiguous contradiction. The sharp divide between traditional Orthodox Jews opposed to statehood and political Zionism is an old wound that has plagued Zionists from the beginning, a wound that has reopened after 7 decades. The belief in creating a nation of European Jews in Arab and Christian lands has led to a century of war that we witness today. Israeli regime fights Hezbollah in the north and Hamas in the south, but its most formidable enemy is history itself.
Iqra. بسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا.
قد عودتك ربي بقرآنك جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسانك ودعوتك ربي بقرآنك.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. May the peace and blessings of Allah be upon the soul of Prophet Muhammad and his purified progeny. Dear audience, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of the program Let's Recite the Quran, coming to you from the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I'm your host Mahdi, and we are joined by Quran expert, dear brother Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam, brother Mahdi, and Assalamu alaikum. Dear listeners of this program, I'm glad to be with you as always.
Thank you. Well, dear audience, as you may know, this program consists of different Quranic parts. First, we are going to talk about a famous Quran reciter, and then we are going to listen to a recitation by that reciter. After it, Brother Muhammad is going to analyze that recitation. Besides these parts, we're going to have some other Quranic segments which are going to be presented to you. So, dear audience, stay tuned. Today we are going to listen to a recitation by Sheikh As-Sayyid Mutawalli Abdul Al. He was an Egyptian reciter who was born in 1947. At the age of 7, he memorized 3 juz of the Holy Quran, and when he got 12, he managed to memorize the Noble Quran completely. During the time when he was memorizing the Noble Quran, he learned tajweed rules and took part in Quranic gatherings as a reciter. At first, he followed the style of Sheikh Abdul Basit and Sheikh Mustafa Ismail, just like many other beginners. But very soon, when he was only 13 years old, he invented his own style of recitation, and that is one of the points that makes him stand out among other Quran reciters. In 1980, the Egyptian radio and television started to record and broadcast his recitations, and that was the time when his powerful voice was heard from beyond the Egyptian borders. He traveled to many Arab and African countries in the Islamic month of Ramadan to recite the Noble Quran. In 1992, he was invited to Islamic Republic of Iran as a referee of the 18th International Quran Recitation and Memorization Competition. And after the competition, he visited some cities including Qom, Mashhad, Kerman, Yazd, and witnessed the Iranian enthusiasm towards the Noble Quran. He passed away in 2015, at the age of 68. May Allah bless him. Now it's time to listen to Sheikh As-Sayyid Mutawalli Abdul Al reciting verses 16 to 21 of Surah to Maryam. Let's enjoy it.
واذكر في الكتاب مريم إذ انتبذت من أهلها مكانا شرقيا فاتخذت من
لا
Dear audience, what you just listened to was recitation of Surah Maryam, verses 16 to 21, recited by Sheikh As-Sayyid Mutawalli Abdul Al. And now, Brother Muhammad, let's talk about this beautiful recitation.
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The first verse that Sheikh As-Sayyid Mutawalli Abdul Al recites is verse 16 of Surah Maryam. And we have Ra Sakina. It's really important to pay attention to how Ra Sakina has to be pronounced with either Tafkhim or Tarqiq.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The point is that you shouldn't pronounce Ra Sakina with Qalqala. And this is extremely difficult because in colloquial Arabic, usually the Ra Sakina is pronounced with Qalqala. For example, Mara'a. We hear that the Ra has a kind of qalqala. The same is true with respect to Ayn. Ba'd. Okay, we shouldn't pronounce Ra or Ayn Sakina, which are both letters of Tawassut, with qalqala. And this is what Sheikh Mutawalli Abdul Al does. Wadhkuru. That's incorrect. Wadhkuru fil kitabi. Maryama. So you have to hold the Ra a little bit without any qalqala.
Mm-hmm. And to pronounce it with tafkhim.
And with tafkhim here because it's preceded by a letter with fatha, mm-hmm. Maryam, and dhamma, wadhkur.
Mm-hmm.
And the word udhkur, yes. You have Ra, sakina, preceded by a letter with dhamma.
And with tafkhim, we mean thickness. We have to actually
thickness, yes.
Make the mouth full.
Yes. For example, if we were to pronounce it with tarqiq in the word fir'aun. This is a ra sakina.
With tarqiq or thinness.
With tarqiq. Idhintabadat. We have ikhfa of nun sakina. Idhintabadat.
Because ta is a letter of ikhfa.
That's right. And so you have to approximate the place of articulation of ta without making the tongue touch the place of articulation of ta. Idhintabadat. And also, you have to make a nasal sound at the same time for two vowel counts. This is ikhfa.
And actually, the first step is to omit the noon.
Yes, you should not
pronounce noon at all.
You should forget about the place of articulation of noon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's no noon
anymore.
We only approximate the place of articulation of the letter after the noon.
Mm-hmm.
And what remains of the noon is the nasalization.
Yeah, or we can say, because ikhfa means concealment, we can say a noon conceals behind the letter of ikhfa, that is ta here. And what yes. is actually audible is the ghunna of noon.
Right. Min ahliha. Now, this is the opposite of ikhfa. Min ahliha. You have to pronounce the noon sakina clearly and from its own place of articulation. You don't approximate any letter. You don't do idgham.
Yes.
Which is impossible. Mi ahliha, that's impossible. Or there's no ikhfa. Mi ahliha again. You shouldn't do that. You have to pronounce the noon.
As it is.
From its original place of articulation and with all of its characteristics.
Because actually we have a letter of throat,
Ilhar, yes, the letter of throat after the Nun Sakina.
Could you remind us of those letters?
We have six letters, and they're like pairs, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Each pair has the same place of articulation, but one is voiced,
the other is voiceless.
Hamza and Ha, they're pronounced in the glottis.
Mm-hmm.
Hamza is voiced, Ha is voiceless. Ghain and Kha, they're both pronounced with the root of the tongue and the uvula. Ghain is voiced, Kha is voiceless. Ayn and Ha, again, they're both pronounced from the same place of articulation. Ha is voiceless, while Ayn is voiced. So these are the six letters of the throat.
Thank you. Let's continue talking about the tajweed points.
Yes, let's go on to verse 20. Anna, we have a noon which is mushaddad, right?
Yes.
And so we have to apply ghunna,
nasalization
for two vowel counts. يَكُونُ لِي غُلَامٌ وَلَمْ. Here we have idgham of nun sakina. What does idgham mean? Idgham means merging one letter into another letter. And in practice, it means that one letter is omitted and the other letter is pronounced with tashdeed. So here we don't pronounce the nun sakina. Instead, we pronounce the next letter with tashdeed. Ghulamun becomes ghulamualam.
And here, because we have waw, ghunna should be applied.
Yes, ghunna should be applied to the waw because it's one of the letters of yamun.
Thank you, dear Brother Muhammad, and thank you, dear audience of IRIB English Radio, for staying with us. That was the final part of the program, Let's Recite the Quran. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. And don't forget to visit our website, that is parstoday.com. Until our next program, we'll leave you in Allah's care. Have a nice time and goodbye. ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان هو القرآن ضياء يملأ الآفاق ونور يبعث الأشواق وفيه محاسن الأخلاق هو القرآن.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines, the Syrian army says it has repelled a major terrorist group's offensive on the city of Aleppo and inflicted heavy losses on them. Iran has reiterated its support for Syria, saying that the resurgence of terrorist groups there is a U.S.-Israeli plan following their defeats in Lebanon and Palestine. And also, Israel presses ahead with its genocidal campaign against the Gaza Strip,